Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, a podcast from the Book Report Network, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love. We know authors cannot travel everywhere, so we want to bring them to you, wherever you may be. Hi, it's Carol from BookReporter.com, and I am very excited about it, welcoming Fiona Davis to our latest Book Reporter Talks To interview.
Welcome. Thank you. I am thrilled to be here. This is fantastic.
Oh, no, it's so much fun because you and I have spoken on so many occasions that I am excited about being able to talk about your complete battery of work in one afternoon.
Fantastic. And to be in front of the wall of books
is a real honor.
So
it's part of my life. You have your own wall over here. So I have been a longtime reader of Fiona's books. I actually discovered her first with The Dollhouse, which was written about the Barbizon Hotel, which had a special relationship to me because I'd worked at Mademoiselle Magazine, and our guest editors always had stayed at the Barbizon Hotel. So that's how I found her books, just by that little trigger word. Second book that she wrote was The Address, which was about the Dakota, which is the iconic hotel on the Upper West Side that I've always craved wanting to be in and live in. So that was wonderful. And the last book, The Masterpiece, was set at Grand Central Station. And no, that's wrong. It's Grand Central Terminal. Let me get that right, folks.
I wasn't going to correct you.
But we've been through that. Grand Central Terminal, where there was an art studio that was there. And it was something I knew nothing about. And we had the pleasure of taking a tour last year together of Grand Central and seeing where this location was set and where you had gotten your inspiration. So I'm very excited today to be talking about The Chelsea Girls, which takes place at the iconic Chelsea Hotel, which many of us know as a place where, let's see, artists, rock musicians, actors, actresses, and other roncateurs of the arts.
Good word, yes.
Roncateurs of the arts.
Exactly.
Would spend some time.
Yes.
So what made you decide to write about The Chelsea?
So The Chelsea, it was different from the other books because the other books, I found the location first, did all the research, and then whatever struck me from the research, either characters or plot, is what I would focus in on. And I knew if something surprised me, then it would surprise the reader. Mm-hmm. And so it really started with the building. And The Chelsea Girls came from an interview I did with an actress in her 90s.
Wow.
Yeah, her name was Virginia Robinson. She was born in 1909. And she was an actress on USO tour during World War II. And she just described in the most detailed terms what life was like back then. And for someone who's writing a book, that's what you want. You want the details.
All the little details. And to have somebody, she was 98, did you say?
She was 98.
98. Yeah. Is she still alive?
She passed away last year at 99.
Oh,
yeah.
Awesome. And had you talked to her along the way about your writing or what she had given you as far as ideas were concerned, or was it just that one interview?
No, we did three over the course of about a year and a half. And she was amazing, and she'd gone through this USO tour, and then she came back to New York, and she talked about understudying for Fay Wray and Vivian Leigh.
Oh, I love this. I love this.
It was so great. And I remember she described Vivian Leigh as traveling with 30 pieces of luggage and a cat.
And remember the days when you could travel with 30 pieces of luggage?
Yes.
Now it's two and you have to pay.
Right, so exactly.
And it would come off the conveyor belt and everybody would be the famous luggage. Not anymore.
And she was incredible. And then she started talking about the McCarthy era and what she went through as a blacklisted, with all the actors who were blacklisted.
Right.
And what a dark time it was. And that's where I thought, oh, that's an interesting story. And to be honest, at that point, I was writing my second book, and I was thinking of doing three timelines.
Oh, whoa.
Not two.
Temporary insanity.
Lasted about a week. But that's when the idea came to mind. And the more I talked to Virginia, the more I realized this story deserved its own book.
Right.
And then I had to figure out where to set it.
Oh, so you knew that you were going to write about actresses, and then it was what iconic building am I going to use to put them in?
Yes.
So the Chelsea's under construction, renovation right now. So could you get in there before they started the renovation to do some looking around?
I had been there in my 20s.
Okay.
And I remember popping my head in the lobby and all the paintings and the sculptures and things. It's this really crazy, quirky, eccentric building. And it's kind of inviting, but also intimidating. Mm-hmm. It was really strange. But it's under construction. It was bought by a corporation. And so where it had been this hotbed of artistic intrigue, now they're turning it into a boutique hotel.
Oh, something new and different in New York. A boutique hotel. Everything's a boutique hotel.
And there's 50 guests still living there.
Oh, really?
And I was inside. The beautiful stairwell in the center is still there. And it'll be interesting to see what they do. But I think it will change dramatically.
So it's still closed for renovation, but the people are living there and on a separate entrance or whatever?
I don't know how they're managing. Yeah, it's horrible.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I know you wanted to have a launch party there.
I know. scaffolding's still up.
Well, I have also decided in New York that the business to be in is scaffolding. Because if you really walk down any street,
yes.
there's scaffolding. And there's really high-end scaffolding. This morning I walked past the plaza, and theirs was painted blue and white.
Yeah.
And they had this beautiful awning in the front. But really, I just go for basic scaffolding, because like looking out any window at any point right now, that's what you see.
Book so, Reporter Scaffolding, Inc.
That's exactly.
You're done.
New business. Little silent. And maybe what we'll do, we could put artist words on the scaffolding.
Yes.
We could just sit there and say, what book is this from? You can win
exactly.
copies.
Exactly.
Maybe that's how we preview books going forward.
We're done.
All right, this became a business. Like, you heard this right here. So when you were speaking with her, you were talking about the McCarthy era and McCarthyism. And I have to tell you, until I read this book, I was not thinking of it involving people in the theater. I thought it was just Hollywood. Did you always know that this had been something?
No. As I started doing research, I was really surprised at how the Broadway scene, it was more of a gray list than a black list.
Okay.
But there was this thing called Red Channels that was published in June of 1950. And it listed all these actors and organizations and then all their offenses, meaning what they were being pro-communist about.
Right.
And if you were in that, if you were listed, you were in big trouble. And the FBI would investigate you. A number of residents who lived at the Chelsea Hotel were investigated. I know one that was imprisoned.
Wow.
And so that's where the Chelsea Hotel made the perfect location
perfect
for that
location.
Book.
Yeah, it was like this perfect intersection of what's going on. So
yeah.
You have two characters. Tell us about them. Because I always love because you have fabulous names for your characters. And how do you come up with those? And then tell us a little bit about them.
You know, I figure out what year they were born, and then I do a Google search for popular names at that year.
Okay.
And then I scan through them and make sure I haven't used them before.
Mm-hmm.
Because with each book, there's two timelines, which means there's eight stories.
Right.
And I seem to be drawn to the same name, so I have to be very careful. And so it's Hazel Ripley.
Right.
Hazel Riley, I'm so sorry. Hazel Riley and Maxine Mead mm-hmm. are the two main characters in the Chelsea Girls. And
those are perfect names for
yeah,
the time period. They're totally perfect
yeah,
names.
Yeah, and Hazel's kind of a reluctant actress. She's kind of forced to do it because of her family, and mm-hmm. that's the family business. But it's not really her thing. And Maxine is a real blousy redhead who's out there to take the world by storm. So they're opposites.
Mm-hmm.
And opposites at first hate each other, and then they attract.
You open the book at a USO show, which when you talk to me about your research, I now understand where this is coming from. What made you decide that was the kind of scene? Was it because it was a big scene that you were going to start out with?
You know, I was researching the USO tour and thinking that might be a good way to start. And I came upon this black and white footage. It was newsreel of these two boys. One was very blonde, one had dark hair, who were Italian collaborators during World War II in Naples.
Mm-hmm.
And they both looked, they were so haunted. They were so young, and the photo was so compelling mm-hmm. as to what happened, what was that story. And so I decided that's where I would set it and have these two women encounter these two boys.
And then where that would go from there.
Let it go from there. Yeah, it was very visual where that came from.
Well, you know, McCarthyism, the blacklist, and what it did mm-hmm. to whole industries of the arts always takes me back when I sit there and read, especially a story like this, where even if they're fictitious characters, mm-hmm. of how people's lives were impacted by this. And was that something that when you heard about, was it just, I'm so riveted, I've got to tell the story of this in depth?
Absolutely, because there's so many people we don't know because their careers were mm-hmm. just about to take off and then decimated. So we don't know the plays that should have been written or the performances that should have hit the stage. And there's so many people who are just as angry today, 70 years later, in their 90s.
That their careers were taken away from them and everything was gone.
Yeah, it really just was a terrible, terrible time and very arbitrary as to who got picked and called out and who did not.
And you know, it was interesting too because we were coming off the war where there was a lot of not trusting in other countries, mm-hmm. but here we were all unified. And I was really thinking about this the other day, that the 50s divided us in such a huge way over this communism, what was happening, which was, we had just come through something where we'd been so unified, the greatest generation, and then we go through this.
Isn't it interesting? I had the same thought because it felt like, okay, we have a common enemy during World War II.
Right.
And then we have all this energy and where do we put it? So right. Let's just turn on each other.
Turn on each other, and they were turning on communism by going through each of these people. And a lot of times it was people in the arts that were so high profile mm-hmm. of what was going on and was happening to them.
And keep in mind, they may have just donated a coat to a clothing drive for Spanish refugees who were fleeing Franco. It could be as innocent as something like that. And then they were called out. And also keep in mind, being communist was not illegal.
No.
The Communist Party was a legal political party.
It was a legal political party. It was something that you could be at that point.
Yeah, but it was about ideology.
And it was about one person saying that this is the way I think it should be, and then getting a tribe of people behind him.
Exactly.
Your dedication in this book I found very interesting because it's for all the artists whose dreams were lost. Mm-hmm. And as an artist yourself through the years, as a writer, and we'll talk about the other things you've done as an artist through the years, could you even imagine a time of censorship like this where you couldn't do your craft?
Oh my goodness, it's so hard to imagine. And also the thing is, it was insidious. It wasn't like, well, no, you're out. It was, you couldn't get a job.
Mm-hmm.
It was this very quiet thing of, you know.
You just weren't hired
for
that job.
So yeah.
You didn't know why you didn't get it. There's somebody else we can choose.
Yeah.
There's somebody else that will get this part. And you always wonder if it's your talent. And then later on, you're finding it had nothing to do with your talent. It had to do with political affiliation.
And exactly. And many of the stories in the book are taken from real people's stories.
Of what would happen mm-hmm. to them along the way. And, you know, I often think that besides the you know, Red Scare and what happened then, I was likening this a lot to the AIDS crisis as
yes.
I was reading
yeah.
your book, because I was thinking a lot about how many people we lost in those years, and as a result, what talent never happened? What did we never see in designers, in fashion, in the arts, in movies, in every single you know step of the arts? And it was a span of how many years, and it was that same kind of a loss.
Yeah, yeah, oh, absolutely. And so you had people who were just completely disappeared,
mm-hmm.
and then you had others who named names before mm-hmm. the HUAC, the House on American Activities Committee, and therefore got to work.
Mm-hmm.
And you have people like Jerome Robbins who named names and went on to great fame and fortune, yet at the same time, because he was gay, he was being blackmailed
wow.
by the FBI.
Wow.
And really had to do that because being gay at that time was much worse than being a communist. And so his life would have just been over.
And what, so the arts were taking all these very dark turns at the same time as everything was so happy and
yes.
bright up on Broadway. And I really just hadn't thought about any of this, especially since so much has been written about Hollywood, that when you're writing about this, I think it's, I'm looking forward to hearing what readers have to say as yeah. the time goes on, because I think it's such a fresh story and such a fresh storyline.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
And you know, okay, so back to the hotel for just a second
yes.
though. So did you get floor plans? Did you see anything of like you know how you were going to write about the hotel?
Yeah, you know, I do so much research, and there's a wonderful architectural historian who I always go to first.
Okay.
And we met for lunch, and he brought me this huge file filled with articles and photos about the Chelsea, including floor plans.
Oh, I love it.
And
I
there was
it.
A secret tunnel. Which, of course, I had to incorporate
you're
into the plot.
Yeah, I really think that you also need to go visit the secret tunnel at some point, because I think that needs to be part. I think you
I
need
know.
To do a little press group of us going, just
yes,
like we went.
Yes.
Yeah, just like we went to Grand Central last year.
Right.
So,
yeah.
When it reopens, we'll go.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll break in.
We'll break in. So you went and you actually were looking at the floor plans to sit and see what would happen.
Yeah, it's always interesting to see how it helps me visually to figure out how spatially the whole thing is laid out and what were the big apartments and what were the small ones. And there's a wonderful book by a woman named Cheryl Tippins called Inside the Dream Palace, which is a nonfiction account of the whole history of the Chelsea Hotel.
I love it.
That
I
was
love
my
it.
Bible.
And it was, the hotel opened, when was the 1880s?
1884.
And that same building in 1884, so they've just gutted inside through the years, or is it?
It's changed over the years.
Okay.
They've broken up apartments and merged them, but there's always been this huge roof where everybody would come up, and there's trees and flowers, and there's always been a restaurant.
Inside?
Yeah. Yeah.
And a lot of people never left the rooms when they went there, too. It was like, you know, there's reclusive rock musicians in the 60s and 70s that was, you know, hanging out of the Chelsea.
It was a refuge. Arthur Miller, right, who actually testified before the HUAC.
Right.
He, after his divorce from Marilyn Monroe, he sought refuge in the Chelsea and lived there for a number of years.
It's refuge. Mm-hmm. That's the perfect word to keep describing it. Just keep So you were an actress at some point. So tell us about that time in your life and how much fun it was writing about actresses, knowing what you knew, or an actor, I should say, not even actress these days.
In
those days, it was the actress. You know, now everyone's an actor.
Yeah, it was so much fun. I came to New York. I went to acting school. And then I got in with a group of friends who created a theater company, and we put on 3 shows a year, Shakespeare, Genet. It was amazing, and we did everything. We hung the lights, we swept the floors, we sold the tickets. And one of our shows went to Broadway and was nominated for a Tony Award.
It was a whole other life.
And for that show, a friend and I, we were the costume designers on it, which meant we went to thrift stores and bought things. But I have a Broadway costume design credit, which is ridiculous.
This is... And you could just have your costume in the costume exhibit someplace. This is the costume that I put together for Broadway.
I don't think it's still around, probably. But it was so much fun. And all my friends from then are my friends still today. And so that was just a wonderful time.
Well, it'd be really fun to see what they think of the book, too.
I know.
Because it's their world. And
yes.
The theater world is such a tight community. And it's a tight group of people. And have you found that same thing with writers, with other writers?
Yeah, absolutely. Here in New York, there's a whole group of us who are historical fiction or women's fiction writers. And it's just been incredible support, and you feel like you're part of a team. And we meet up for drinks or dinner. We go to everybody's book launches. It's an incredible world.
And you know, it's really fun too, because you're not competing against each other the same way would you be for getting roles in the theater. It's
right.
Not the same thing. You just all want bookshelf space.
Yeah.
And there's room for everybody. Whereas there was one role, and mm-hmm. you could be up against it with your best friends or your people that you knew very, very well. And now this is completely different.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, because readers who read a lot.
They read Broadway.
So if they like one book, then they'll like another. You know, it's like if you read City of Girls, which is about Broadway in the 40s, which I just finished and was
And
fabulous.
You absolutely love that book.
Oh, I loved
it. I was seeing that online. You were crazy about that book.
But I feel like, great, people will read about theater in the 50s now.
It's very, very good. And I think that's what we want people to be doing too, is if you fall in love with an idea, there are other books about that subject that you may be interested in talking about.
Yeah, with maybe a different angle.
Yeah, but a different angle and looking with a different lens.
Yeah.
You clearly like chasing down a rabbit hole to look for information. Was there any, besides your fabulous interview that, you know, started the whole idea for this book, was there anything that when you were down the rabbit hole you discovered and said, that is really cool about the Chelsea Hotel, or there were so many moments?
Well, definitely the tunnel. That was definitely one. And in a way, it was tricky because there's so many famous boldface names who lived mm-hmm. at the Chelsea. I was almost overwhelmed with who do I include. And it takes place in 1950, but then it jumps to 1967.
Right.
And so what I found I had so much fun with was in 1967, if you know who stayed at the Chelsea Hotel, you'll recognize the characters who are in the elevator or passing through the lobby.
Right.
Without calling them by name.
Because you just do a description and you say,
yeah,
I know who that is.
The guest at the time would be, you know, that's just some rocker.
Right.
You know, oh no, it's Leonard Cohen. And so that was a really fun way to kind of weave in that true history.
And you know, it must be fun because you do get on the elevator there, and then I remember one time I got an elevator with someone very famous on the elevator, and they looked at me like, please don't.
Yeah.
And please don't tell the story.
Did you?
And I said, I'm not going to do what you think I'm going to do. I'm going to tell you that I was on an airplane with you a couple of months ago, and people were sitting there, and it was Ed Bradley, right?
Okay.
And I said, I was sitting in the first row of coach, and you were sitting in the last row of first class. And everyone stopped as soon as they went through and said, there's Tom Brokaw. There's, you know, Morley Safer. And no one got your name right. And I said, but I want you to know that everyone knew that you were someone famous coming through. And it was this look of relief on his face, that it wasn't like you're going to ask me what story I'm working on or something like that. And I think that a lot of times when you're staying, if you're an artist and you're staying in a place like that, no one's going to bother you.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of what people want, is you're just in the elevator.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not like the days of TMZ coming and taking your picture.
No.
It's just you're there.
And the Chelsea Hotel, you were equal to the fashion designer, to the playwright, to the artist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just all these creative types being eccentric and wild and madcap and drinking a lot.
Drinking a lot was a big thing. It was a very big part of this. So your characters, what happens with them? So we start out on this USO tour, mm-hmm. and then what happens to them along the way?
Yeah, so they part ways, and then in 1950, Hazel is living in New York with her mom and pretty miserable, doing radio where she has to do, you know, animal noises, and not happy. And she really wants to be a playwright now. She wants to take this story, this image that they saw, and these boys that they met in World War II and make it into a play, but she's stuck. And she ends up at the Chelsea Hotel, which really is her muse in many ways.
So she's using the hotel as her inspiration
for
what she's going to do.
Yeah, and she meets up with Maxine again, and they try and put the play on Broadway.
and where the story all goes from there. And then she's, instead of being the actress at this point, she's writing.
Yes.
So she's moved in this different direction. I wonder if there are any similarities there between the author.
That.
Imagine that we actress moving on. Boy, we're really deep for that research, right?
It was a lot of fun to kind of recapture that, because as I made the transition from actress to journalist,
right,
it was that same thing of, okay, what do I like to do? And the answer was, like, I really like to be alone a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And writing and researching fulfills that. And then going out on book tour fulfills a whole other side of meeting people and getting, you know, all this creative energy back.
And it's also the reason you're good when you're on book tour, because you know how to project and you know how to, you know,
I think it helps.
You're acting a lot. I mean, it's definitely like you're projecting your story, but you definitely have to be enthused and in the moment. I've been to some readings where the authors just are not into it and plugging it in, and you can tell. And mm-hmm. it's just, you know, it's just not the same thing. So what made you decide to give up acting? What made you say, I'm going to walk away from this?
You know, I was in my late 20s, and I noticed that my friends who are a little older, who are the ingenue new type, mm-hmm. weren't working anymore. It was getting mm-hmm. harder and harder. And my male friends who were older were working like crazy as they aged into really great character roles.
Uh-huh.
And I just thought, well, that's not really fair. And what else do I want to do? So I applied to Columbia Journalism School and went there and got a master's. And I actually wrote my thesis on the shelf life of a New York actress.
Oh, I love it.
And really explored it through the breakdowns in the casting, how the roles change depending on your age and your gender.
And what happened through the years. So journalism, what does that bring you as far as a skill for being a novelist now, the discipline?
That's a really good question. Yeah, the discipline, because if you don't write, you don't get paid.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing precious about sitting down and doing 1,500 words a day or whatever. And also, I think I'm not afraid to get out there and interview people. Mm-hmm. And I don't like to just do research at home. I want to go out and meet people, because that's where you find, you know, the really interesting story. Like for the masterpiece, I was interviewing a historian, and he said, oh, if you're looking at Grand Central School of Art, you should look into this woman named Helen Dryden. And she was this amazing illustrator who lived in the 1920s.
I had totally forgotten that covers of magazines were illustrated.
Yeah.
They were not photographed. And these beautiful illustrations for years, and then those people all lost their jobs.
Yeah.
As soon as photography became the main job, like this was what was going to happen. No different than supermodels have been now upstaged by celebrity.
Yeah, that's right.
So we had these trends that happen in arts and happen in the culture that change along the way.
You're right.
But when you were writing about that, I was sitting there thinking, wow, all those beautiful illustrators, what happened to those people? Because they were actually illustrating the ads as well as what was on the cover of the magazines and every single piece that was inside.
Right, right. It's tricky. They eventually, I guess, became graphic designers.
But illustration is such a lost art today of what you can do, just that simple silhouette, or what you can do with a few lines that was definitely the order of the day for so many years.
Yeah, the old Vogue covers
that
Helen Dryden did were amazing.
And
beautiful.
I even look at the old original Vanity Fair from the 1930s,
exactly.
And you see the original drawings. And, you know, working at Condé Nast, we had a fabulous library upstairs, and everything through the years was up there. And sometimes at lunch, I would just go up and peruse the old magazines, because everything was in these bound volumes.
Mm-hmm.
And you would go up and say, it was such a different way of presenting information.
Yeah.
And I think that we forget about a lot of that.
And for me, that's a major thing that I do as I research each book, is go back and look at the old Mademoiselles or mm-hmm. the old magazines that were out at whatever time period I'm investigating, because that shows you what people were worried about, what they cared about, what they wore.
Right.
And so that to me is the way in.
If you ever need any of Mademoiselles from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, I have them at my house in boxes in the attic. And I have 20 years of Rolling Stone magazines.
That's probably worth some money.
I've already tried on eBay. I don't think they're worth as much as I dreamed they were worth. They're just in lots of boxes, which is the reason you need a really big attic to keep this stuff. But no, but when you go up and you look at those, you realize how different journalism was.
Yeah.
You realize how different news gathering was at the time. And when you were a journalist, it was reporting. It mm-hmm. was not just writing. It was not just writing about topics. It was actually going out and seeking news.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I wrote about health and fitness and the arts and that kind of thing, but you still had to go out and get sources.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think that really, when you're doing research for your books, it was the thing that you call back is all those skills. And as you said, you weren't afraid to go ask questions.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is like, you know, an absolutely huge thing. Were any of the books easier to write than the other? Like, you've got four here now. Was anything easier, or either the storyline or the setting?
You know, I think the Chelsea Girls The storyline was a little easier because instead of going back and forth between two different time periods,
right.
It's two time periods, but you're going straight through from different points of view.
Mm-hmm.
So each woman is telling the story, driving it forward.
And that was different for you.
And it's a little different.
It was a little different because mm-hmm. in the others, we were jumping time zones.
Yeah.
We were jumping because one woman would be in one decade and one would be the other, and you'd be trying to figure out how you put the two of them together.
Yes.
Here, I was seeing something different. You were trying something different with your craft, which is a big deal to
yeah.
sit there and say, I'm not going to write in form.
Yeah, and yet still give people two different time periods and you know, have be able to compare how this building has changed over time and how the occupants have changed over time. Mm-hmm. So that was fun. But all the books kind of have this element of mystery that drives it forward. So it's just easier in one timeline to plant clues
mm-hmm.
than
right.
in two, where if you give something away in one time period,
you've got to remember.
You're in trouble.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, you got to sit there and pick this up and figure out from
yeah.
there. So do you keep copious notes about, because you do have a twist in this book that were, and it was a fantastic twist.
Okay.
Did you know that at the beginning, or did you that's where you started and work backwards from the
yeah.
story?
Yeah, I knew okay. that. That came really early on. And I do plot out my books beforehand.
Oh, you do?
Yeah,
okay.
I do. So I know kind of where it's headed. And that came to me on, I didn't know if I'd be able to pull it off.
Because
mm-hmm. It's a big one.
It is a big one. But, it really is big.
But so far, it seems to have worked.
Yeah, and people are just sitting there saying, yeah, because I often think that if you don't plot with the twist, mm-hmm. is it more difficult to do? Some people have told me that they fall into the twist as they're writing, and then after, you know, write back
yeah,
from there.
Yeah.
And writing backwards, I would find incredibly Ooh. Difficult.
Yeah.
Incredibly difficult to have to be able to do.
Yeah, the journalist in me doesn't want to waste words.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Let's not have anything. And it is, because your writing is not too flowery. I've had a lot of complaints from readers recently going, I could cut 100 pages mm-hmm. out of this book. I could cut 50 pages. And I never feel like I'm feeling that way as I'm reading one of your books. The writing is so tight and the storylines are progressing so much. But I think that's a real call that people are seeing at this point mm-hmm. of, I just can't do this. It's just overwritten.
Right,
bloated.
Right. If you take 2 pages to describe a room, you're just going to lose the reader.
Right, unless yeah. it's something that is really exciting happening
yeah.
in that room.
Yeah.
But a lot of times it's even with characterization or dialogue or just not moving the story along. There are 4 pages that just didn't move it anyplace.
Yeah.
And do you find that you're constantly looking at that, being careful as you're writing, or is that more of the editing process?
That's more of the editing process. And I do tend to write pretty streamlined and then add in more later. My
uh-huh.
first draft is pretty
lean.
And then I kind of pepper it once I feel solid about the story and the characters, because it's really getting to know your characters.
Yeah, and is there ever such a thing as too much research? Meaning you've got so much that you can't even crystallize what's really going to work for this book.
You know, I find at a certain point in the research process, I'm you know, overwhelmed and mm-hmm. nervous. Will I find a story? What's in here? What am I going to do? And then at a certain point, it just kicks in and I'm dying to start plotting.
Just starting and
yeah.
start writing.
And so that usually happens about 3 months into the research period. And so far that's happened, but we'll see.
We'll see what happens going forward. So what's your favorite part of living in the past? Like when you're going and doing this, do you visualize yourself living at this hotel?
I love the costumes and the way people spoke to each other, and I like the rules because it's great to write a character who wants to be free and fight kind of the establishment, but is hemmed in by the rules of the day.
Right.
It gives me something to work with, and it gives the character a way, something to overcome.
And I think that we right now, because people mostly do what they want in this day and age, you forget about what the rules were like, whether the
yeah.
rules were like in business, in theater, the way you put on a show on Broadway is the way you do it. And a lot of times that is still happening on Broadway.
Yeah.
The people, if you try to usurp the system, it doesn't completely work out
yeah.
because there is a real hierarchy in there, which is completely different from Hollywood.
Yes.
You
yeah.
can actually be an interloper. But to break in on Broadway as a young director or a young designer would be very, very hard.
It's a small club.
It's a small
yeah,
club. Like
yeah.
Hamilton could not have been your first production.
No.
And it was like playing rules along the way.
Yeah. Yeah, so. but it's good the way Broadway seems to shape itself over time and adapt accordingly. Because there was a while about 10 years ago where they're saying, oh, Broadway's boring, it's over.
Right.
And now there's so many great things, not only Broadway, but off Broadway as well.
There's a huge resurgence. And I'm hearing more and more of my friends talking about going to the theater
than
I had heard for years and years. And we're going to come back to the theater in a minute.
Okay.
Well, do you write and research at the same time, or like as you've done a bunch of research, you mm-hmm. start writing,
mm-hmm.
and then do you pull back and say, I'll go back if I need something later, or are you, I'm going full steam ahead?
I will write that first draft and know and leave brackets where something needs to be researched or filled in. Or like the book I'm working on now, I went out and got a book on typhoid.
Okay.
Because I needed to know more.
Right.
And so I'll stop and
read about typhoid for a couple of weeks. Let's see, this weekend I think I'll read about typhoid, then I'll go back to writing a novel, you know, da, 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 da.
Yeah, so it changes, but I do try and, once I start revising, I'm in writing mode.
You're also very disciplined. We've talked about this in the past, about your writing, mm-hmm. like your writing time. And you try to leave that sacred, like during the day, of what to do. Tell us a little bit about, you know, how you shape your day to make sure you have that writing time.
Yeah, you know, I try and block it in, especially in the morning, because that's when I do better work if it's writing. If it's editing, I can do it throughout the day.
Right.
But that thing of coming up with a sentence or describing a person or a feeling, I find I have to do it in the morning because that's when my energy is best.
That's when your energy is at peak.
Yeah.
And when you sit and you're writing in you've described your office and you have a mirror angled so you can see the Hudson. I would love this. Yes. Tell us a little bit about the office writing space.
Yeah. So it's a dedicated room in my apartment, and my apartment faces south. So if you look out the window and to the right, you can see the Hudson River. So I have a mirror up, and I don't look at myself. It's angled so that I can look over there and watch the barges float by.
I love it.
And there's something about water that I think is so helpful to the creative process.
It's you know, calming.
If I can't think of a plot or I'm having a problem, I'll go for a run along the water, and it always comes to me.
Interesting. And it's just breaking out and being able to see along the water as you're running.
They say there's something in the ions that's creative.
This is good. Yeah. If I get blocked, I'll just go out and look at the pool.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, exactly.
It's supposed to be the reason more time it's hard, the pool. It's a hard time in writing, you know? So were you always that disciplined, or does that something, was that from your journalism days, or was this something that you really, when you started to write a novel, which was a completely different, you know, experience, was that when you realized you had to become more disciplined?
No, you know, I always was. When I was 8, I really wanted a piano, and my parents said they'd buy it as long as I played it for at least a year.
Okay.
And so I got in the habit of practicing for a half hour, an hour a day, and I did that until I was 16. And that, I think, was the key, because I could see how by doing just a little each day, mm-hmm. added up,
and it could get better.
Yeah,
you could get better at what you're doing.
And mm-hmm. but you don't have to feel like, oh, okay, I have to write a book. You just start small and break it up into stages. And so I know that if I write 1,500 words a day, I'll have a book in about 4 months.
About 4 months. Mm-hmm. So when you were first writing Dollhouse, this was a totally new experience. And now you're on a book a year kind of a thing. It's like, you know, the little, like, running in the wheel, like, da-da-da-da. When you're writing that, how long did it take you to write the first book?
That took a couple years because I was really learning...
The craft.
On the craft, yeah, on the fly. And I got my wonderful agent, and then we worked on it together for a good year to get it into shape. Because I just didn't know what I didn't know.
Right. And I think that a lot of people just sit there and go, oh, I could just draw a book. And then they're not realizing what is really involved in this. Yeah. And it's also, there's writing, and then there's editing, and there's rewriting. And a lot of times when I'm speaking with authors, there's like, you know, there was a lot more that went into this that we added things later on. I was talking to somebody last week in an interview we were going to run in September, and he actually added 2 pages. When he was in, you know, very late in the process, it's not in the galley because he realized that something needed to happen, and it just, the book was like missing if that didn't happen.
Okay.
And that was a luxury at that point. But, you know, there's sometimes I do read galleys, and then later on the book is different, the final book, because you see something along the way.
Yeah, and it's distance from it that helps you see the bigger picture.
Yeah.
And so you need to do that. You need to step away and then go back to it and then go, oh, yeah, that was crazy.
So now you've been an actress, so... As a result, do you read your book aloud to yourself to hear how it reads?
I do, and I did it even when I was a journalist, because I read quickly, mm-hmm, and by reading aloud, you slow down and you see what words are echoes, mm-hmm. you hear it, and you also see what words are missing.
You know, it's interesting what you say about reading your books, because digital audio has exploded, mm-hmm. as far as that's how people are reading these days. Yeah. And as a result, if the cadence isn't right in the book, or if you haven't done that exercise that you've gone through, I find that there could be something missing when the audio experience is happening.
Yeah, because it's so different to read versus to hear.
It
really is, and certain books lend themselves to it so beautifully.
I also am a very fast reader, as you are, and I think I definitely skip a lot of words. You know, I know you wrote them all and they all value, but I know I'm reading very, very quickly. But when you're listening on audio, yes, you can speed it up, mm-hmm. but It's not quite the same thing. You're listening is a completely different thing. And what I find is that you really do get to get the words all right, and the cadence on the what's happening, the pacing of the speaker has to be exactly, you know, right in order for it to do it. Now, can you listen to your books on audio, or is that something where you sit there and go, oh?
I will listen to it just because I'm dying to hear what the narrator did with it, and they're all so good at what they do. It's a real joy to hear.
Has it been the same person, or has it been different people?
No, it's changed, yeah.
Oh, interesting.
And it's fantastic. But I can't listen to all of it just because I'll start editing in my head.
Right.
Because there's always something. You can always change something.
Well, they're often, they don't allow authors to record their own work because if they do, and even when people, memoirists, people do it an awful lot. Mm-hmm. And they said that, I want to change this on the page. And they're like, you can't. You have to read exactly what's there. Yeah. You can't make it up to be something different. And I also find sometimes people are pronouncing words and I'm like, either I've been pronouncing that wrong my entire life or they just did it wrong. So I'm not quite sure.
Right, you know? Right. They tend to come to me if there's pronunciations or accents that they have questions about, which has been fun, just to kind of, I don't know, let me think about it.
Well, you know, both my children learned to read by sight, like just were sight readers. So for a long time around our house, there were words like epitome instead of epitome. And I was like, what is the epitome? And he's like, the epitome.
Yes.
And I was like, I have no idea.
Yes.
And it was a pint of milk instead of a pint of milk.
Course.
A pint. And I'm like, where are you getting a pint of milk? But it was just because they learned to read differently. And as a result, sometimes, especially if you're with a book group, there's a woman from Book Passage who actually gave me this great idea that if you're doing a book with a book club and you've picked the book, later on, go back and listen to it, because it'll get you to figure out how to pronounce all the names that you were just saying, Hazel, what was her last name?
Right.
Or certain settings or accents or whatever, so that when you get together with your book group, you'd be able to do that.
Yes.
So
that's a great idea.
You've spoken to a lot of book groups, I take it, through the years. Has there been anything that you've learned from book groups about your own work? Because so many times people are sitting there like, I didn't see that when I was writing the book, you know?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm trying to think. Oh, I just had a really lovely book group here in New York, and there's a character in The Masterpiece who grew up in Stuyvesant Town, and then she marries this wealthy lawyer and they get divorced and all that. And there's something about how the husband doesn't like her humble beginnings. Mm-hmm. And one of the women in the book club said, I grew up in Stuytown, it's not humble. And I was like, I'm sorry, okay.
I have to take that back.
It's his point of view.
Yeah, it's his point of view. This is what he saw. I love that.
Yeah.
But it's also that sharing experience, because they're just, and they're, are they always asking you what you're going to be working on next?
Yes.
That's like the big question.
Yeah.
So what are you working on next?
Yeah, I'm very excited. The next book is set at the New York Public Library. And it's set,
which is just so much rich in history.
Oh, it's great. And they've been wonderful. And I've spent a lot of time there. And it's two stories, 1913 and 1993.
Ooh.
So it's jumping back and forth again.
Right.
And 1913, what I learned in my research was that the superintendent lived in the library in a 7-room apartment with his family.
7-room apartment in the
library.
How
nice. Yeah, beautiful.
That's like a dream.
Yeah.
That's like a dream. Just having all the books like right there.
Exactly. And so I have it from the point of view of his wife, who wants to be a journalist and goes to Columbia Journalism School, as one of the first women to go to journalism school there. And then it's 1993 from the point of view of a curator who's trying to put on a show of an exhibit of rare books. They keep on being stolen.
Oh,
and there's book thefts of both eras, and you have to figure out who's stealing them and how is this happening.
And would you actually go down to the stacks? Or do they have you go down?
They did not let me down, security reasons. They don't. But there's been tours, so I can read about them, and I've interviewed people who've been
in the stacks.
Have you been in
the stacks? I've
been
in the stacks.
I'm so lucky.
Years ago, when I was with on the board of New York's Book Country, which is not an organization anymore, someone brought us in and gave us a really deep, dark tour. We were underneath where Bryant Park is, like that whole area.
Yeah.
It was... all this, it was really, yes, it was very, like, you had to be very careful as you were down there.
Yeah.
But it was, they were working on the reading room at that point. It was all under construction. A very, very interesting time to see how the history that goes into the museum. And I remember learning what the lions' names were, which I just didn't know any of these little tiny facts about this place that I passed every day.
Yeah. The name of the book, we just found the title, is The Lions of Fifth Avenue.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Oh, and that'll be next summer?
The
summer of
2020.
So, okay, let's, we have to go back to theater for a moment. What are you loving on Broadway these days? So as we're saying, you're saying, you know, so many people are going to Broadway. A lot of people I know are going to the shows that are based on musicians, like which is this whole different kind of Broadway show that everybody's, you know, going towards. So what have you loved?
The last thing I loved was Ink.
Okay.
And that was a play Manhattan Theater Club did. I'm on their board, so I'm, you know, I feel strongly about it. But it was this wonderful play about Rupert Murdoch and his rise.
Oh, wow.
And so it starts in the 60s. Right. It takes place in the 60s in England as he comes, this brash Australian who's buying a newspaper in London and kind of throwing everything into you know, chaos. And it was a wonderful show, and it was wonderful because it humanized him. It's someone who, you know, a lot of people feel they know, but it took you on this journey, and, and you learn things, and you kind of see where things come from.
But you also see, too, that there was a beginning of what he was doing.
Yeah.
And everybody knows where somebody's now, but the risk that was there up front.
Yeah.
And there's so many times with you have a vision of somebody, and they're a character. It's a caricature at this point. And you get to see him as a character, I'm sure, by we're going to that play. So when you go to a show, and you've been on the other side of the stage, and do you actually visualize what the actors are going through up there? Like, are you thinking the way they're performing their parts at the same time?
You know, if I'm often just so enraptured in whatever they're doing, because there's so many amazing actors here in New York that I'm just lost in the story.
Okay.
But yeah, every so often I'll think, oh, you know, I would have done that differently. Yeah, I think you can't.
It's
you
that
can't
natural
shake
kind
it.
Of a thing. It's that natural kind of thing. So do you do the same thing when you're reading books? Do you also think of how I might have done this differently, or are you reading straight through? Because I often wonder if writers are as critical as other people's writing.
I am constantly writing going, how did she do that, or how did he do that, and going back and folding down pages and, you know, to go back and look at later. I find it so inspiring to read really, really good writing, but I read it as a writer.
You read as a writer. Yeah. If you're writing, can you also be reading? Can you read for pleasure at the same time, or do you have to check out on reading anything from anybody else?
If it's a really good book, I'm lost.
You're and lost.
I'm just like I was when I was 14. Yeah.
And how about when you write? Do you listen to music or dead silence?
No, dead silence. Yeah. Yep. No, absolute silence.
I'm a dead silence kind of person for anything that I have to write, except if it's a music that I know every once in a while that can be playing in the background, but nothing new.
Yeah.
Nothing new.
Yeah, your brain's trying to work that out instead of what it should be doing.
So when you're writing, it's 4 months of intense writing that first draft, and then from there, editing for and page proofs and everything for the rest of the time, and then you're balancing that with promotion for the book that you have going out.
Yeah, yeah. And that's getting bigger and bigger, which is wonderful.
Right.
But so I have days blocked off in August when I'm not on book tour just for revisions and keeping that schedule and meeting the deadlines.
And switching gears.
Yeah.
Being able to do that switch gears.
Yeah.
When you're sitting and you're, let's say you're working on the next book, I've often said that you're in this book, when you're in the zone on this book, do you do a lot of the ancillary writing, like the extra pieces that you're going to need, that you're going to know you want to put up on your website, or the little notes for interview questions, because then you're moving into a different world. Like now you've moved into the world of the library. Do you find it easy to switch back and forth?
No, I tend to, when I'm writing, I just write. And then it's always a kind of a joy to go back because, for example, Chelsea Girls was really turned in January, and now we're in summer.
Right.
And so it's really fun to kind of go back and revisit it and to hear the interview questions and see what captured people's attention.
See what they're picked up from there.
Yeah, right. And so that's what really directs me in my author talks is doing interviews like this where I can see, oh, right, okay, that's where I should talk about.
And also I would think that talking to book groups, that same kind of thing happens. Now, do you do, but can book groups sign up on your website if they want to speak with you, or do you have certain parameters for doing book groups?
No, I tend to do Skype and FaceTime book groups here and there, and they can find me on my website and contact me through that.
And when you do those, how long do you usually talk to a group, just so we can build up expectations? 10, 15 minutes?
Yeah,
what do you usually
usually the book group meets on their own for a half hour to talk about the book, and then they kind of Skype me in for the last half hour to ask questions and kind of go over what their thoughts were.
You know, and I've heard this from a number of book club groups that sometimes they wish they discussed the book the month before, like done the whole thing or done that half hour up front.
Yeah.
Because many times they say, oh, we're just going to call the author. But they haven't talked about the book themselves, and they don't have any bearings about what their questions might be.
Yeah, and it's so great to hear people's opinions.
Yeah.
You know, what they liked, what they didn't like. It's fantastic.
And people are very opinionated to share exactly how they...
Yeah, which
is great. I think you should have done X, Y, Z.
And not all books, you know, I don't like every book I read, and I don't expect readers to. So it's really fun to hear what people have to say. And luckily, so far, everybody seems to be very happy, so that's nice.
And I'm not going to ask you to pick a favorite book, because I could tell you that of the four that I've read, I couldn't pick a favorite.
Oh.
I've enjoyed each of them. I've really enjoyed each of them.
Thank you.
And I've learned so much from each. If you haven't explored Fiona's work yet, I would say start with the new one and then definitely look at the last three as well, because you're going to be able to have this really immersive experience into history, but at the same time with some really great storytelling.
Thank you.
I am so delighted that you joined me today.
Oh,
we've talked on so many different occasions, but to have an opportunity to share with our readers as well. Thank you.
Thank you. This is fantastic.
And till next time, Book Reporter readers, it's been a pleasure. Thank you. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from The Chelsea Girls by Fiona Davis, narrated by Kirsten Potter and Hillary Huber, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Penguin Random House Audio. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Book Reporter Talks To. You can read more about the author and the books discussed in this episode in our show notes, which can be found on our website, bookreporter.com. There are three ways you can support this podcast. First, subscribe so you never miss an episode. Second, share it or tell a friend about it. And third, rate or review us, as that will help people discover us. This episode is brought to you by the Book Report Network. Thank you to our producer of today's episode, Austin Rue. And now, hear an audiobook excerpt from The Chelsea Girls, read by Kirsten Potter and Hillary Huber.
She hated Maxine Mead and Italy on first sight. When Hazel had first auditioned for the USO tour back in New York, she'd imagined arriving abroad and gingerly stepping off a plane to a cheering group of GIs. The stage would be a grand opera house or something similarly picturesque, like what she'd seen in the newsreels of Marlene Dietrich and Bob Hope entertaining the troops. Hazel would be sure to call them men, not boys, as the USO Actors Handbook advised. After all, many of them had been fighting for 4 years now. They deserved respect, as well as some wholesome entertainment, a respite from the fighting. Upon boarding the Air Corps plane at LaGuardia Airport, Hazel was informed that she'd be replacing a member of an all-female acting troupe who'd come down with jaundice. Not until the noisy tin can of a cargo plane was aloft was she told her destination, Naples, Italy. After a bumpy landing, Hazel lugged her two suitcases off the plane and stood on the tarmac, exhausted and confused, waiting for someone to tell her where to go, what to do next. The stifling heat was made worse by the fact that she'd been given the winter uniform, including wool stockings and thick winter panties. Every inch of her from the waist down itched as though she had ants crawling up her sweaty legs. Her uniform, a greenish-gray skirt, white blouse, long black tie, and garrison cap that she'd admired in the mirror back in New York, was now a stinking, wrinkled mess. Finally, a soldier pulled up in a jeep and called out her name. He tossed her suitcases in the back before helping her into the passenger seat. They lurched off over a road battered by potholes, passing demolished apartment buildings and churches. Several women picked through a pile of garbage by the side of the road, stopping to stare at Hazel with dead eyes before turning back to their work. A group of ragged, emaciated children, one of whom sucked on his dirty fingers, watched the scavengers. Yet across the street, a tidy line of schoolboys walked past the desolation as if nothing were wrong. The air smelled of rotting vegetables. Dust kicked into Hazel's nose and made her sneeze. Early in the war, the newspapers had published aerial photos of the city that showed almost all of it up in smoke, annihilated by relentless bombing. While many of the inhabitants sought safety deep underground in the ancient Roman aqueducts and tunnels, at least 20,000 people had been killed. She tried to envision what it would be like if New York had been similarly decimated, she and her mother out with their shopping bags, stepping over chunks of concrete, going about their day. She couldn't imagine it. "This is terrible. There's hardly anything left," she said. The driver shrugged. "Naples was the most bombed site in Italy. The residents rose up and resisted the Germans, right?" She tried to remember what she'd read in the papers. "Looks like they paid dearly for it."
"Sure did."
He made a sharp left off the main road. "They told me to take you directly to the stage." She would have thought they'd give her a moment or two to freshen up after her interminable trip. "Is the acting company rehearsing?"
"Nope, it's a show."
He nodded at the men trudging along the side of the road in the same direction, smoking cigarettes.
"This is your audience."
At the sound of a low rumble above them, every helmeted head snapped up, scouring the skies. But it was only thunder, from a slate-colored cloud to the west, far out over the sea. The helmets snapped back down. A show. Good. She'd have a chance to watch the other actors. In New York, she'd been given the script for Blithe Spirit, which had been a big hit on Broadway 4 years earlier, along with instructions to learn the maid's role, and she had managed to memorize some of the lines during the flight. The lines were the easy part for Hazel, as she'd been a serial understudy for the past few years. Hazel's hope, when she first auditioned for the USO, was to be able to break out of her understudy rut and finally act on stage in a real performance. This was her chance to try something new, so that when she returned to New York, she'd be taken seriously as a major actress, not just a backup to be called upon when the leading lady got the flu. Which, with Hazel's bad luck, had never happened. She'd even established a reputation among producers. Hiring Hazel Ripley as an understudy guaranteed that your leading lady would never miss a show. 20 plays now under her belt without going on even once. Every night she'd feel a guilty flicker of relief as the star flounced through the stage door, healthy and raring to go. But Hazel attributed her own reticence to her lack of experience. Surely once she'd gotten a taste of performing in front of an audience, she'd become just as competitive and eager to take center stage as her brother and father had been. She was a Ripley, after all.